tools and techniques can flow between groups through the social channels created by family relationships. These newly expanded networks will increase the size and complexity of the repertoires of tools, skills, practices, and know-how. So, at this point, there will be more cultural complexity in the world, which means that larger brains can more readily pay for themselves because there's more to learn. Later, once our ancestors began acquiring packages of social norms that prescribe, extend, and reinforce behavioral patterns, pair bonds transform into marriages, and fathers into dads. Reference Chapter 9. Cultural evolution has even repeatedly enriched the relationships between a son and his mother's brother, which anthropologists call the avunculate. The avunculate is a special relationship that often helps link different communities. Nephews get special privileges to visit and obtain gifts from these particular uncles, and learn stuff. To emphasize an earlier point, social norms mean that, although these relationships are underpinned by some basic aspects of primate kin psychology, they are now also monitored and enforced by the community, by third parties. Thus, by intersecting with the know-how pathway, the sociality care pathway contributes to crossing the Rubicon in several ways. First, by expanding the kinship network, a combination of pair bonding and social learning both creates more opportunities for learning from others and fosters alloparental care from newly located relatives. Kin bonds increase social tolerance, which, by creating more opportunities for learning from others, fuels the cultural evolution of larger and more complex suites of tools and know-how. Such suites put an even greater premium on equipping individuals with the psychological abilities and motivations to be able to learn from others. Eventually, as skills get hard to learn, this situation opens the door to at least some simple forms of teaching, since we now have experienced individuals who recognize their relatives and have various incentives to invest in them. If nothing else, an offspring's kin network won't, and often can't, easily hide valuable know-how, skills, or food extraction techniques. Second, the care and investment provided by newly bonded relatives and those seeking to learn about infants allows mothers to more quickly get pregnant again while at the same time allowing her offspring the time and opportunities they need to tune into the expanding body of practices, tools, techniques, and expertise that are becoming increasingly available. The result will be larger brains and the longer childhoods needed to fill those brains with know-how gleaned and honed through a combination of observation and play or practice. Farther down the road, of course, cultural evolution will shape social norms and deploy social technologies like rituals to establish and maintain expanded networks that link groups and individuals across large populations.
So we're back. We had a fire alarm go off, as you could probably tell, mid me talking. Obviously, the man was trying to get to me. So anyway, all safe. I'm good. Nothing burned. It was a failed sensor. Anyway, so I probably missed a few talking points that I was going to put in there, but I could hear what was going on in the background. So anyway, so there's, so in the probably the last segment, there we've been talking about pair bonds, and I thought about the subject a lot and have formed some ideas about the effects of long-term committed pair bonding, mostly in the context of why communes tend to fail, a topic that I would like to explore further. I have have a couple books on it that I've tossed in the queue and been thinking about it and how to talk about it, because since we're talking about communities and how to form them, and one perfect example of communities and why they fail, and I've different experiments, the communes that happened in the 60s. They've also happened in the late 1800s. There were a lot of communes, including the Oneida, a group that was named after the Native American group, among others. And interesting to see if there's any commonalities for or lessons learned that why those communities broke up, or these communes broke up. So anyway, so, and one of the main theses of why communes failed during the 60s is the lack of creds, which we just talked about, credibility enhancing displays, and a reduction of the social norm of committed pair bonding. I think Heinrich makes a balanced case for each side, pointing how common non-committed or limited pair bonding is in many societies. It's very common across many societies where you see not necessarily limited pair bonding or non-committed pair bonding. But also makes the case for why committed pair bonding may have a positive effect on modern society. The reduction of socially destructive violence and increasing cooperation are, I think, a strongest case for the practice. It's a fascinating subject. I'll definitely plan to cover in the future, mostly in scholarly articles, but hope to do it in person field studies. That's a joke. Anyway, did you hear it? So I think a lot of it has to do with the availability. A lot of the speculation or reason why it decreases violence in societies is because if you have a large group of males without dedicated pairs, they can often usually create more violence or chaos in society. And that's why otherwise you could have a select group of males that just basically collect all the females, and then you have a gang of other males that don't have anything better to do with their time than causing chaos. So that's the theory behind it, but other societies have learned how to mitigate some of those effects, or there's a whole big field of study which we'll talk about in detail. I won't go into the detail, but he does make a case in this book about why committed pair bonding has positive effects in group learning and communities and culture. But he also makes the distinction that it's very common not to have those, so pluses or minuses. So anyway, let's get back into it. We got another 4 minutes left on the book, so we're going a little bit over, and then I'll have a little summary at the end about some of the stuff we're covering next week. So keep on. We're not on fire. Everything's okay here. I didn't burn up. Everything's good at the radio station. So anyway, well, let's finish up the book, and we'll make some commentary at the end. So, and we'll play a public service announcement at some point.
Why living apes haven't crossed the Rubicon. Understanding the importance of group size, social interaction, and pair bonding for cultural accumulation helps us understand why living apes haven't crossed the threshold into a regime of cumulative cultural evolution. Gorillas, for example, do pair bond, but live in single-family groups with only one male and several females. These groups are too small for cumulative cultural evolution. Similarly, orangutans are rather solitary and don't pair bond, which means that young orangutans often grow up with only their mother to learn from. With little access to others for social learning, it's very hard to generate aggregations of cultural know-how. Chimpanzees are more group-oriented, but have a fission-fusion form of social organization that still means that young chips mostly hang around their moms. Studies of how infant and juvenile chimpanzees learn to use stick tools to fish for ants or termites show that young chimpanzees really only have access to mom as a model, 90% of the time, though when given the chance, they will watch others, usually older female relatives. Thus, the narrow evolutionary bridge across the Rubicon I've constructed begins with a large, ground-dwelling ape who is forced to live in larger groups by predation, in which at least some members of both sexes have evolutionary incentives to pair bond. In summary, the key to explaining why our lineage crossed the Rubicon and so many other species have not is to understand how we solved the startup problem. Bigger brains, calibrated to rely on learning from others, can't pay for themselves unless there is already a lot to learn out there in the minds of others. So, assuming we are starting with a creature with good individual learning abilities, for example, big apes, we first consider the conditions that would favor increasing the amount of know-how one could potentially learn without increasing brain size. Terrestriality gives a boost by providing better opportunities for individual learning and more chances for social learning. Predation, by forcing primates to live in larger groups for protection, increases the size and interconnectedness of groups. Both terrestriality and predation will thereby increase the size of groups' cultural repertoires and may begin to push a species past the threshold. Nevertheless, expanding brains to store more cultural information still face a crucial obstacle: the high cost to mothers of investing in offspring, who take a long time to grow up and learn what they need to know to survive. Even when this pays in the short run for mothers, it can result in extinction in the long run when famines, droughts, and floods hit. Circumventing this constraint, the larger groups of social learners created by predation can also lead to the spread of pair bonding strategies, which eventually expand kinship circles, increase social learning opportunities, and favor greater alloparental care. Combined with the increased production of high-quality foods made possible by more cultural know-how, due to more social learning opportunities, the alloparental help delivered by relatives and others to mom and her offspring lower her costs in the short and long run, which permits her to produce children more rapidly. This opens the door for a massive expansion of brains, increasingly selected for their cultural learning abilities.
So that ends up the segment. And the other thing we miss, owl parenting, refers to the care of offspring by individuals other than the biological parents. So like maybe grandparents or aunts or uncles or neighbors or things. We missed that definition because we were stuck outside because the fire alarm. So anyway, we'll play a public service announcement and then get into maybe some of the stuff that we might be covering next week, including just a little bit of a wrap-up about this since we went over about this book, The Secret of Our Success. One other thing that I got cut off talking about, how important community involvement of policing forces are in the community, because to build the trust between the community uses reason, and it is important because having that communication between the police and the community is one way. If you don't have that, then other people are going to have to rely on honor cultures to enforcement. So the reason why you often see honor cultures kind of stick in certain areas is because the lack of trust between the police force and the community, and the cultures that are developed in those areas can persist where they have to rely, if they can't rely on the police to enforce law, they have to rely on their own. So, which is brought up in the book, Why We Fight. I would highly recommend that book to go over some of the causes of violence. He's a little more of economic spin on a lot of his ideas. So, but I think he makes a fair judgment. I mean, and he brings in a lot of modern evolutionary biology in economics theory in his explanation, so I think it's still valid and very interesting regardless. Anyway, let's play a public service announcement and then we'll just kind of go over what we're covering next week really quickly, because we ran out of time, and fire alarm and all that fun stuff. Anyway, so let's play the public service announcement.
We touch a lot of things in our busy lives, from shopping carts to cash to doorknobs. As to not spread germs, it is important that we keep our hands ultra clean by regularly washing them. Remember to lather and scrub your hands for 20 seconds before rinsing. Make sure to get in between the fingers and under your fingernails. Wash all the suds away under clean water and dry your hands completely. Hand sanitizer is a good substitute if you are in a pinch. However, it has proven to be less effective than washing your hands with the good old soap and water. This message has been brought to you by your squeaky clean DJs at 90.1 WRUV FM Burlington.
So we're back. So next week, we'll probably dive into ideas from The Secret of Success might influence public policy, especially in education, and revisit the classic nature versus nurture debate through the lens of the flu problem, which we covered back in March, April with Michael Sandel's series, Justice. So I think, obviously, Secret of Success is definitely making a cultural environmental push and connection to see how most of these our ideas and our collective intelligence has a greater influence on innovation and productivity in communities more than genetics. So and there's many different ways you can approach that argument. There, he's not making the case for that genetics, that people, that certain intelligence isn't broadly, you can't see pockets of intelligence or people are more intelligent than the others, but there's a lot of evidence that kind of pushes against that environment isn't a huge part of that. And there's things like the Flynn effect, which we touched on briefly, I think, but there's a, if you look at the IQ tests over the last 100 years, they've gone up by about 30 IQ points. So, and that kind of point definitely points to genetically, there's no way that could happen that proves that there's some environmental effect that's definitely having an effect on IQ scores throughout the last 100 years, despite what people, most people's theory, like with idiocracy, thinking people are getting dumber. Most tests, either depending upon, there's some people that measure it's like, well, it's flat. If you look at IQ tests, which are supposed to be something you can't learn, clearly that's got to be wrong, at least in part, because you see the increase of 30 IQ points over 100 years. So anyway, there's clearly something that can be learned or some environmental effect. Some people speculate it's lead in our environment, but even then, there was a great increase in lead because lead and gasoline in our environment through when we started using it. You imagine there should be a dip after that. I don't think the evidence really shows that. But anyway, we kind of get into the debate. So some of the stuff we'll be covering next week and maybe a little bit later in the future. The flu problem, who should get the best resources? Should be the best performers now, the ones with the most potential, everyone equally. So we'll cover fairness in the lottery of outcomes. How should we control? How much control do we have over our successes? How much is inherited, genes, environment, and support? And is meritocracy just repackaged luck, which we covered in the Justice series? The lottery of needs, what talents and skills does society reward today? So there might be certain things that we reward today that may be worthless in the future, worthless, quote unquote, or less rewarded in the future. And how are we building incentives around short-term utilities, like tech skills and test scores, and how some of those might not be valuable in the future? And what do we lose when we have a narrow value? We've overvalued narrow outcomes for certain things that we want. So, and Bentham and utilitarianism and social priorities, which we covered Bentham with the Justice series back in April, May. Oh, yeah, I imagine everyone remembers that. If we maximize innovation and productivity, is that enough? What about purpose, wisdom, community? And do these values create long-term good or just short-term gains? And key policy outcomes to examine, rising inequality, misaligned productivity incentives, and unintended consequences of narrow educational pipelines or economic policies. So those are some of the key ideas we might cover in the future, just to kind of give you an idea on some of the stuff we might carry. So we kind of built the framework to at least pose some of these questions and possibly hypothetical answers about these questions. And while there are some clear holes in knowledge, there's some clear holes we could probably cover in our knowledge. Some of the books I recommend that we haven't covered, if you want to do reading on your own, yes, homework, no, I'm just kidding. Tyranny of Merit, which I've read by Michael Sandel. He also has, he talks about it on some of his lectures and interviews. It's very interesting. The Years That Matter Most by Paul Tour. The Innovation Delusion by Vincent and Russell. Measuring Up, and also Measuring Up by Daniel Koretz. And Range by David Epstein. Which I've probably talked about once or twice. I've also read the book. It's very good, very interesting. And it's kind of a Range and Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell have two different polar ideas about how should you have narrow focus and 10,000 hours as opposed to general focus. So there's the Tiger Woods opposed to the David Federer model of how you should build skills. So, and they've actually, David Epstein and Michael Gladwell have met in the 92nd Street Y talk, where they talked about their ideas and discussed each other. So, which is wicked cool when people have kind of polar opposite ideas and come together in a civil way and be like, oh, so I think some of your ideas are probably disprove some of my ideas and blah, blah, blah. That's a very interesting YouTube thing. We might discuss it a little bit in the future, but that will tie in with some of the stuff we're talking about. And so some of the counterpoints to maybe to the points we're trying to make about collective education or maybe how we educate people today, in Defense of Liberal Education by Fareed Azarika. I know I'm mispronouncing his name wrong because I can picture, I've heard him talk at least 30 times. But anyway, in Defense of Education and The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley. So that kind of covers some of the books that we're covering. So, yeah, we're going way over time than I expected. So my general tenured approach to problems with its more holistic mindset, I don't think there's ever just one solution that fits all situations. I found that opposing ideas often hold pieces of insight and pieces that don't often hold up and when you try to apply like an idealistic idea to a problem. I think the tension between those ideas can be useful between opposing ideas. It's more of a dialectical approach, like the tradition of Plato or Hegel, that can bring certain ideas to light. So, which we'll probably cover Hegel a little bit in the future. We've talked about philosophy, but there's the synthesis, antithesis, and thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, where you take the two opposing ideas, societies digest them, and creates a new idea to make something new as an interesting concept. You also kind of tie certain how my ideas kind of tie with Eastern philosophies, which kind of embraces contradictions rather than trying to erase them, like Taoism and Confucianism and Zen Buddhism, all point to the idea with what's true or effective in one moment might not hold in another. Context matters. So, yeah, So we might talk about those in detail. I don't have a lot of detail in Eastern philosophy. And if you live in the United States, most of the things that you're being exposed to are Western philosophy, which is a ton of. There's a Mindscape topic done by Sean Carroll. There he brings in someone that studies Eastern philosophies and talks in the context of philosophy teaching in the United States or Europe in general, and some of the ideas from that. I might bring that in as an excerpt and talk about it a little bit. And of course, there are people at UVM that teach philosophy that talk about the subjects as well. So we might have we might get them involved at some point. Anyway, I wasn't expecting to go over half an hour. We're expecting to wrap this up quick and easy, and we'll end on time. Ha ha ha. Anyway, we'll play you some music as I wrap up some of my equipment here. And you can email me at Radio Lyceum, RadioLyceum, all one word, at protonmail.com. And if you have any suggestions, comments, etc., etc., I won't be here, so you know, good luck trying to call the station, 656-4399, because there will just be automation. There won't be DJs on until tomorrow. Or the chat. So anyway, feel free to email me at the Radio Lyceum at protonmail.com. This has been James. You've been listening to Radio Lyceum. This is WRUV FM Burlington. Let's play you some music. Enough of me, Chad and Jen. So right now you're listening to Tenderlessness After the Storm. Stick around for the automation. I might play you some songs too. Thanks for sticking around.
Essa confusão não morrer, enfim, eu insisto, quero te fazer ficar afim com meu coração, desejo sim.
Thank you. Hey, this is Jack from Dead Poets Society, and you're listening to WRUV 90.1 FM, Burlington, Vermont.
Heartbreak, 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 heartbreak. Unlock the corners of my little mind. Of the freedom kind, where I might find another heartbreak, another heartbreak, another heartbreak, another heartbreak. Oh, I feel it or feel nothing at all. You know, you're gonna need someone.
Bye.